Welcome to the Veritas Podcast. For even more exciting content, visit our website at www.veritaswbc.com. Enjoy the podcast.
Hey, everybody. Are y'all doing well tonight? I'm glad that you are here. It's a good evening, and I have the privilege of introducing our guest for this evening. For some of you, you already know him because we went on a trip with him. About 100 of us packed up and went over and started in Italy and grabbed a cruise, and we went through Italy, down to Malta, over to Greece, and then up to Israel in over 15 days. I'm telling you, we were beat by the time we got back, but it was the trip of a lifetime. So tonight, my esteemed guest is Dr. Craig Evans, who is a professor at Houston Baptist University. He is a professor of, actually has a chair, the John Bassanio Chair of Christian Origins at Houston Baptist University. I was looking back at this, Craig, because I was like, how many books has Craig written? And it's over 70 books. And I feel completely inadequate. He's over here doing this. He's like, a little higher. At least 70 books. At least 80 books. I've done three. Talk about inadequate. Author and editor of more than 70 books, hundreds of articles and reviews. He's given lectures at Cambridge, Oxford, Durham, Yale, and other universities, colleges, and seminaries, and even museums. Craig has even, by the way, as I was looking back at this, has been on Dateline NBC, no doubt to do the forensic work, with some investigative work for them. Dateline NBC. He's also been on the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, History Television, and others. And apparently, Craig, I didn't even know this, you were a consultant for the National Geographic Society, but even more than that, for the Bible miniseries. You remember the miniseries that came out, the Bible miniseries that was produced by Mark Burnett and Roma Downey? I didn't even know this about this guy, and we traveled over four countries over 15 days together, and he never brought it up. I'm going to give the rest of the time this evening, but remind you that what we're going to do is he's going to be speaking. The topic tonight is, so what can we really know about Jesus from history? And then the second one is, why does it even matter? And so would you welcome Dr. Craig Evans, please.
Do I have a control for the slides?
They've got you up there.
Okay.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. Thank you very much.
And if you want coffee, by the way, coffee's over here. Help yourselves, okay? Thank you so much. All right, now, Craig, you can take it.
Hey, very good. I'm going to have to turn around occasionally and see what's on my slide so I'm reminded of what I'm doing. Oh, I think I can see it from here in the back. Good. Let's go to the next slide. Yeah, what can we know? I want to start on a philosophical note. I'm not going to stay there. I'm going to get to the stuff I know well, which is historical Jesus, the Gospels, and things relating to that, like ancient texts and archaeology. But I thought I'd start just for a few minutes on a philosophical note. That's René Descartes, who is famous for saying something. Next slide, please. Yeah. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. And he stated that, in 1637 in his discourse on the method of rightly conducting one's reason and of seeking truth in the sciences. I'm familiar with a lot of very old books, 19th century, further back, 18th century, of course, not too many in the 17th century, but it's really funny how long the titles can be on some of these books. They're almost a paragraph long. But he made that famous observation about, I know I exist. However feeble my brain might be, however my mind might be limited, maybe I am being deceived, maybe there's an evil genius out there trying to fool me, but I'm here being fooled, so I know I exist. And so that's how he started out, and he made this famous statement in a book in 1637, and then in 1644, a famous work called Principles of Philosophy, which was written only in Latin. Next slide. And so, and these are the covers. And so that's the Principle of Philosophy, and then the next slide, and that's his discourse on method for right thinking and doing proofs and so on. Next slide. Anyway, Descartes is considered to be the founder of modern philosophy, and he should be taken very seriously. Obviously, science and technology and so on have moved forward, and we're raising other kinds of questions that he wouldn't have even dreamed about, but he did lay a good foundation for philosophy and the thing called epistemology. How do we know? And epistemology touches on just about anything, any human inquiry that involves thinking and knowledge. So I'm going to talk about, I'm not going to talk about philosophy as such, and that kind of thing. And I'm not going to talk about science either. I have read a lot about those subjects just because I enjoy them. I minored in philosophy, but I did not minor or major in science. But I do enjoy reading books on science, brain science, and origins of the universe, or what's called cosmogony and cosmology. But anyway, he argues that there is indeed a human soul. It isn't just reduced to a physical brain. I think he's anticipated, he's anticipated some of the neurological science that has been done in modern times, which argues that it is most unlikely that the human mind is nothing other than the physical brain. And of course, he also argued that God exists, and that's touching very much on what we're talking about now, although I'm talking about the historical Jesus and what we can know about him and why those things, things he did and said, do point toward the existence of God who cares about us. But also notice at the bottom of that slide, many argue that modern science, logic, and reason support Descartes. In fact, one who came to that view recently in our own times is Antony Flew. So let's go to the next slide. And this is where I will leave off on the philosophy. But Antony Flew used to be an atheist. Now, how many of you have heard of Antony Flew? And notice it's Antony, not Anthony. Is that all just, do I see a 10 or 12 hands? He was the pope of atheists for half a century, okay, from about the 1950s until his death. He was a confirmed atheist. At Oxford, he heard lectures by C.S. Lewis. How many of you have heard of C.S. Lewis? Just about everybody here. Yeah, C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis, by the way, one of his fields of reading, as the Brits would say, when he was doing his own graduate studies, he read in the area of philosophy. A lot of people know him as a popular writer or a writer of these fascinating novels, which in recent years have been made into movies. But C.S. Lewis was a very deep thinker. He wasn't just a creative mind that could tell great stories. He was also a philosopher. He was a smart guy. And Antony Flew grew up as a young man filled with doubt, skepticism, and he listened to C.S. Lewis. And in the end, he decided he was not persuaded. He would remain a skeptic. But he used to tell friends, and this comes up later, family and friends, that he was Socratic in his skepticism. And that is, as a follower of Socrates, his mind really was open to learn new truth. And so he always said, I'm not convinced that God exists. I do not think the arguments for God are persuasive. And so in that sense, he was like other skeptics and other atheists. Bertrand Russell, for example. I listened to a tape where he, with his funny little accent, talked about how he just found arguments for God incoherent and unpersuasive. But Flew, unlike Bertrand Russell, Flew maintained throughout his whole skeptical career an open mind. Well, he was the leading atheist of the English-speaking world. I think I was meant to say that. Anyway, he announced that he had abandoned atheism and adopted deism. Now, he didn't come out and say, I'm now a Christian or I believe in the God of the Bible, the Judeo-Christian understanding of God. He said, that might be right, but what I'm convinced of is that God now exists. He changed his mind. He believed that science and other developments in reason and logic, so on, forced him to abandon atheism. Next slide. So following the announcement, Flew made a number of statements, and then in 2007 published a book called There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. And that came out by published Harper Row in 2007. He replied to those who claimed that he had become senile or had misunderstood various aspects of philosophy and science by saying the following thing. So, I have been denounced by my fellow unbelievers for stupidity, betrayal, senility, and everything you can think of, and none of them have read a word that I have ever written. And there's the footnote that goes with that in the aftermath. Now, that's his announcement, you know, in response to his announcement in 2004. There is Anthony Flew. Now, some of you know who Gary Habermas is. Gary is an evangelical philosopher. And he became good friends with Anthony Flew and would discuss philosophy with him, epistemology, and the resurrection of Jesus for decades. And Gary was pleased no end when Flew, and you see the title of his book there, There Is. And you can see There Is No is written, and the no is crossed out, and he's changed it from There Is No God to There Is a God. And so, anyway, the world was rocked in 2004 when it came out. You know, people knew he was rethinking everything, and then in 4 he said, I'm not an atheist anymore. I think there is a God. And then his little book came out in 2007. Next slide. In response to claims that Flew either did not understand or did not agree with the contents of There Is a God, actual writing was done by Christian philosopher Roy Varghese, and see, this is what led to conspiracy theories. Flew stated, I have rebutted these criticisms in the following statement. Let's go to the next slide. My name is on the book, and it represents exactly my opinions. I would not have a book issued in my name that I do not 100% agree with. I needed someone to do the actual writing because I'm 84, and that was Roy Varghese's role. The idea that someone manipulated me because I'm old is exactly wrong. I may be old, next slide, but it is hard to manipulate me. This is my book, and it represents my thinking. And by the way, I do know Gary Habermas personally, and in the aftermath of this controversy, after that book came out in 07, Gary told me that he had the opportunity to see that very manuscript. What it was Varghese sat down and conversed and typed and conversed, prepared a manuscript, it got revised. Then when he finally had the manuscript that he thought was correct, he handed it to a Flew, and he went through it page by page, and he initialed each page when he was satisfied with it. And Gary said, I held the manuscript, and there were Tony, that's what he called him, Tony Flew, there were Tony's, signatures, his initials, on every single page. And so the idea that he was senile or was deceived is just ridiculous. Next slide. Flew abandoned atheism and adopted deism because it provides, one, a better account of the origin of the universe, the so-called Big Bang. Number two, it offers a better account of the origin of life, and number three, a better account of consciousness of the human mind. The latter point included humanity's moral sense. And I've read the book, and that sums it up very well. And he then added an appendix saying, if I were to believe in God in the biblical sense, I have to say that, and he cited Tom Wright, you probably have heard of him repeatedly, he said he makes a very good case for the atonement and how God, because he loves humanity, would act on humanity's behalf and through the unparalleled, unique work that God did in Jesus the Messiah. So he actually has a little bit of a Christological statement. He doesn't endorse it. He just says, thinking through it, I have to admit, it makes sense. Now, whether or not he finally embraced that at the time of his death, I don't know. But that's where the story ends, and it opens up the door to what I want to talk about briefly this evening, and then throw things open for your questions. Next slide. I will say no more about philosophy or science because neither is my field of expertise. I will try to say a few things about history, the New Testament Gospels, and Jesus of Nazareth. Next slide. We have four biographies of Jesus that date within one generation of the death of Jesus. The Gospels, and this is what I'm referring to, the four New Testament Gospels, exhibit verisimilitude throughout, as established by other historical sources. For example, Josephus, also a first century writer, who knew of Jesus and commented very briefly on him and his brother James. Also geography, topography, and archaeology. Let me pause here just for a moment, leave that slide up there, and I'll say something about what I mean by verisimilitude. It's a great word, and I encourage my university students to learn it, memorize it, get fluent with it, know how to use it. Then when they go home and they're at supper with their parents, just let it drop in conversation. Then the parents go, wow, you're getting a great education at Houston Baptist University. The tuition is not high enough. Anyway, that's the goal. I'm working on it. I think it's successful. Anyway, it's an important word. Verisimilitude, of course, is Latin, obviously. Veri meaning truth, similitude meaning similar to or like. And that's what all historians are looking for. Historians, if they know their craft, if they've been properly trained and they have documents, they look at them and ask themselves, does this exhibit the realities, the truths that were, you know, real for that period of time? And oftentimes that's how a forgery is detected. It doesn't exhibit verisimilitude. It may fool the non-expert, but the expert is not fooled. The expert knows, no. That just isn't the way it is. There is a specious gospel. It's called the Gospel of Barnabas. Barnabas had nothing to do with it, trust me. It's not an ancient work at all. But Muslims like it because the author of the Gospel of Barnabas has Jesus prophesy the coming of Muhammad. And Jesus renounces his divinity. He renounces the saving effect of his death on the cross. And this is, of course, in keeping with Islamic teaching. So Muslims will say, Christians, you should forget about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You should instead read the Gospel of Barnabas because it tells the truth. Well, here's the problem with the Gospel of Barnabas. It exhibits no verisimilitude. Okay? What are the examples? It mistakenly has Jesus born when Pontius Pilate was the governor. Well, Pontius Pilate didn't become governor till either 25 or 26 AD. Jesus' adult ministry was just about ready to start. So there's a big chronological blunder. Another blunder, it references barrels of wine, wooden barrels, casks of wine. That's not how wine was aged in Israel in this time. It was in skins and ceramic jars. So he's goofed there. One of the classic blunders is he says the disciples were in the boat and they rowed to the shore, and the shore was at Nazareth. Nazareth is several miles from the shore in the Sea of Galilee. I find it hard to believe that they rowed that boat several miles up and down the hills and finally arrived at Nazareth. And of course, the author didn't know that. The author, Capernaum, Nazareth, what difference does it make? But a real giveaway is the Gospel of Barnabas quotes Dante's Inferno, which is 14th century. And so that kind of, hold on a minute. Dante, his work wasn't circulating in first century Israel. And so that's what leads people to say the Gospel of Barnabas can't be any earlier than late 14th century. Some even date it into the 15th century. So that's what a historian does. And so a historian doesn't say, I'm going to reject the Gospel of Barnabas because Muslims like it. No, that has nothing to do with it. They reject it because it doesn't know first century Israel, makes several mistakes. And by the way, I could go on and on and on. The author, for example, doesn't know that Christ is the Greek form of Messiah, which means the anointed one. So it actually has Jesus say this, Jesus Christ said to them, I'm not the Messiah. Oops. So you realize this writer doesn't even know and thinks that Christ is Jesus' last name. See, so I could go on and on. There are these kinds of mistakes. Now, let's go to the first century Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, I've been to Israel many times, and one of the things I like doing in Israel is visiting archaeological sites, and sometimes I participate as a volunteer. In fact, I'm going back to Israel in June, and I'll spend 1 week at the dig site in Shiloh. That's Old Testament related. And I'll sit in a chair and hopefully be very comfortable in the shade, and I'll do wet sifting, okay? And that's what I'll do just for fun, and I'll drive around and visit some other archaeological sites. That's what I like to do. And I'll teach one class at a college in Netanya for a week while I'm there as well. Well, archaeologists get as many people as they can to volunteer. A dig season is no less than 4 weeks. Sometimes there are 6 weeks, rarely they're longer than that, and they try to get as many as 50, 60, 70 people for each two-week segment. Now, do you realize if you're a volunteer, you will not be paid, and you have to pay your own expenses? You fly yourself there, you pay a daily charge for staying in a hotel, you also pay a couple hundred dollars a week just to be part of the team to cover incidental expenses on your behalf incurred by the archaeologist. So if you went for 2 weeks, you'd be out of pocket a lot of money. If you went for 4 weeks, you'd be out of pocket for a lot of money. There could be as many as 100 volunteers at a dig site. In addition to your own personal expenses as volunteers, there's the expense of the archaeologist has. He has to round up at least $50,000, maybe $100,000 for debris removal, equipment, hiring professionals who do certain tasks that the volunteers can't do. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of money and a lot of labor invested in that project. Can you imagine if the archaeologist does not know where to dig? After 4 weeks, he realizes we've been digging in the wrong spot. We've moved 50 tons of earth, and we have nothing to show for it. That would be a disaster. You want to know where to dig. The other thing is when you dig someplace and you find things, you want to know what it is you're digging up. You know, if you're planning on digging in a certain site that relates to the first century, and it's not, it relates to some other time, you realize I've dug in the wrong spot, and I'm finding stuff I can't even make sense of. So my point is, archaeologists tend to be very down to earth. They tend to be very pragmatic. They don't sell out to goofy theoretical ivory tower ideas. There is just, they have too much skin in the game. So they're very down to earth, or as they like to say, we like to go, from the ground down instead of the ground up. So they want to know what they're doing, and therefore they use the best sources they can get their hands on. And if you were to go back to Israel and visit every single site that's concerned with the first century, not say the 9th century BC, but the first century, and ask these archaeologists, and they could be Jewish who believe in God, they could be Jewish but are agnostic or atheist, they could be non-Jewish who are Christian or not, or if they are Christian of any stripe, conservative, not very conservative, it doesn't matter. You could visit all of the archaeologists who are concerned with the first century, the time of Jesus, the time of the early church, and you were to ask them, what are your primary written sources you rely on? I know the answer. They will mention six things. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the book of Acts, and Josephus. Those are your six. They're not going to say, not one of them will say, gosh, I don't know how I'd get along without the Gospel of Barnabas. You won't hear one person say that. You're not going to hear anybody say the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Philip or these Gnostic writings that were found in Egypt and Nag Hammadi. You're not going to hear any of that. You're not going to hear any goofy, strange theories. They're going to say, we use the first century sources that reflect familiarity with Israel. They exhibit verisimilitude. And of course, not surprisingly, and the archaeologists are never surprised, they dig things up and go, oh yeah, that's it. That's what this gospel or Josephus was talking about. This is how it fits into the picture. Now I bring this up because if the gospels were fairy tales, and I've debated Richard Carrier. He's a mythicist. He says Jesus is a myth. He didn't exist. Very few people, thank goodness, almost no scholars agree with that. If Jesus didn't exist, he's a myth. The Gospels are just writing fiction and making stuff up about some guy who never was here and never did anything and obviously never said anything, didn't have any disciples. How are all four of the Gospels so accurate? See, that seems strange. And of course, that's why, guided by common sense as well as evidence, archaeologists ignore that kind of thing and use Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the book of Acts, and Josephus. They may appeal to a few other sources, but those are the primary sources. And so they're guided by them. They know where to dig, and they know how to interpret what they unearth. They rely on these writings. So they go to Cana of Galilee. They expect to find stone water pots because John chapter 2 says that's what the Jewish people used for purification. And guess what? They find dozens of broken stone water jugs, which Gentiles didn't use, but Jewish people did because of the custom of purification. Stone doesn't become impure as ceramic does. And so there are these little details that are an aside that's not really a big part of the story. They just get slipped in. And these little details often then cohere and agree with what gets unearthed and what gets discovered. Okay, let's go to the next slide. Oh yes, the resurrection testimony. This is a very good point. And this obviously is a key thing because if we stopped before this, we could say, okay, Jesus is a remarkable figure, a compelling teacher. No wonder people followed him. And then however you want to explain the miracles, maybe it's all psychosomatic or whatever, Jesus has a big impact and people respond to him in positive ways. But the resurrection isn't psychosomatic, not really. It goes beyond that. So we need to talk about the resurrection testimony. And again, I want to say something about verisimilitude, that is, exhibiting reality the way things actually happened and were understood and experienced in the time. The resurrection testimony is very strong and can be summed up in two ways. One, the accounts in the Gospels are remarkably restrained in contrast to the embellished, reckless, apologetic, and mid-second century gospel of Peter or Acts of Pilate and other writings. Let me explain what I mean. There were pagan skeptics that emerged in the second century who were saying, you shouldn't believe in Christianity. Jesus performed some miracles, so what? There are other miracle workers out there. His teaching, okay, it's kind of neat, but so what? There are other teachers out there. But they all had to admit the resurrection put Jesus in a class by himself. So they attacked it. And you know how they attacked it? Almost always the way they attacked it was, look at who the first witnesses were. The witnesses that got the whole thing started. Just a couple of hysterical women. Why, one of them is this Mary from Magdala, a worthless, wretched little village. By the way, he was terribly wrong. This is Celsus who says this. Obviously, Celsus didn't know what he was talking about. His own criticism exhibited a lack of verisimilitude because Magdala was an upscale city on the shore where the elite lived. But he didn't know that. And so Mary is from Magdala. He assumed it was wretched because she was wretched. And Jesus healed her. So he thought, well, you know, somebody like that has those kind of needs must come from a dumpy, terrible little town. But he targeted the earliest witnesses, women. and in a very condescending, chauvinist way, said, "How can you trust them? A couple of hysterical women, one of whom is from a wretched village." So he shows this huge bias. And in reaction to it, the two texts that were up on the board a moment ago, Gospel of Peter then retells the resurrection account. We know that because we found a fragment, a big chunk of it, in North Africa in the 1880s. And we realized that's the Gospel of Peter that some church fathers talked about, a gospel that's lost. And you know what it says? Everybody was there to see the resurrection, a massive apologetic. And so it isn't just the women who come. Why, they're pushed to the side. They play second fiddle. The male disciples are there. A Roman platoon is there. Jewish elders are there. They're doing a sleepover in a cemetery? I mean, the lack of verisimilitude is terrible. And they're all there watching. It's like, okay, cameras start rolling. This is Sunday morning. And the rock, boom, there's an earthquake. It rolls aside. And two big, tall angels go in. And then they hear a shout. And the two angels come out. And with Jesus between them. And their heads go up into the sky. And coming out of the tomb following them is a cross that walks and talks. And the heavenly voice says, "Have you preached to them that sleep?" And just ask your pastor, Jeremy. He'll say, "Yeah, I do every Sunday." And who answers the heavenly voice? Jesus, you say. No. One of those tall angels? No. It's the cross. The cross goes, "Yep, we did." Now, whoever wrote that, how naive. But the person who wrote this, we think around 140, 150, middle of the second century, imagine that he was improving on the gospel story and was making up for that deficit. That, the earliest witnesses, no, that's not good. It's just a couple of women. Look what Celsus and some of these other people are saying. So he tries to improve the story. By the way, the Acts of Pilate does the same thing, even more amazing, excessively. So what do the canonical gospels do? They just say, well, it'd be nice to tell the story differently, but that's what happened. It was, in fact, two women. And the disciples' initial response was, "You must be delusional," because things had turned out not the way they had anticipated. They had not anticipated or desired a crucifixion. That's not the way they wanted it to turn out. That's why Judas Iscariot betrayed Jesus. That's why Peter denied knowing him. That's why they all ran away. The women end up looking good. At least their devotion for Jesus was such they would go to the tomb to anoint his body. They would be allowed to weep silently graveside, to complete the Jewish custom of 7 days of funeral mourning, and then 1 year later come back and gather his bones and take them back home, which I assume would be Nazareth, where they could be properly buried. Until then, his remains lie in disgrace and shame. That's the Jewish custom. That's why the disciples quit. Well, you know, we know someday there will be a resurrection, but this not this way. So they didn't believe it. Jesus' crucifixion meant defeat. And then the women? See, so that's what the Gospel of Peter is trying to improve, Acts of Pilate and these other things. Let's go to the next slide. Number two, the testimony of Paul. Oh, this is a big thing. So I boil it down to these two things. The way the gospel narratives tell the story, it's the women who go to the tomb first. They're the ones that make the announcement. Male disciples initially are skeptical. But the second thing is, what makes the testimony of the resurrection so powerful is Paul, formerly an antagonist of the Christian movement, and he is very important. It is firsthand. We're not told what Paul thought or experienced. Paul tells us himself. We have a bunch of his letters in the New Testament. In fact, the authorship of the most important ones, the authorship is not disputed by anybody. Galatians, the letter to the Galatian churches, where he disputes with Peter, by the way, on food issues and eating with Gentiles. And 1st and 2nd Corinthians, again, no dispute as to their authorship. Philippians, and in these letters, he talks about his former life of skepticism and opposition to the Christian movement, and then, God was loving and merciful and forgave me and revealed his son to me, and it changed everything. Paul did not believe in Jesus. He did not follow him. There is no psychological explanation. Some try to say that for Peter. Oh, Peter was so close to Jesus. He just couldn't get over emotionally Jesus' death. And it's like, Gerd Ludemann, the German skeptic, uses spousal psychology to explain it. Why, there are women who've been married 50 years, husband dies, and for months, even years, they think they see their late husband sitting at breakfast table with his cup of morning coffee. This is true. And it's something like 40%. So it's true. This is some kind of a psychological thing. But that doesn't apply to Peter. He wasn't married to Jesus for 40 years. That doesn't really make sense. But it certainly doesn't apply to Paul. There was no close psychological connection. Jesus wasn't Paul's crutch, and he doesn't know how to live without him. He did not believe in him. But he meets him on the road to Damascus, and now everything changes. And so he then becomes a strong supporter. Next slide. If the claims of Jesus are true, and this is under the last part of the title, why does it matter? If the claims of Jesus are true, one, we can have peace with God. That's what Jesus' teaching was all about. That's the message of the New Testament's all about, if you boiled it down. Reconciliation between humanity and God, our Creator, peace, shalom, that wholesome, nothing missing relationship. And number two, we have assurance that life truly has meaning. So in other words, nihilism, nothingness, the philosophy that really ultimately we're just a fluke, there's no meaning to our existence, that's been dealt the death blow. And number three, we have assurance for life beyond our own biological, mortal lives. Those are the implications. If Jesus' claims are true, and I'm including in this, of course, the resurrection, it does matter. So it isn't just, oh, that's interesting. What do you know? Jesus perhaps performed miracles. Or what do you know? Well, shoot, put that in the Guinness Book of Records. He was raised from the dead. Man, that's something else. It goes from just an interesting factoid that could get put in the record book to something that truly does matter. Next slide. And time for Q&A. Okay, thank you very much. Look forward to your questions.
All right. This is where I join you, my friend. All right, so just as a reminder, you have a couple of options. One is we have a microphone somewhere. I forget where. And so before we really turn to, thank you, Rhett, you're a scholar and a gentleman. Graduate of Houston Baptist University, Craig.
Of course, absolutely.
Go Huskies. one thing, just for the sake of time, because we may have a number of people that want to ask questions, is if you go to the mic, ask a question. And I say that for a reason. You know, we're here to see what Craig has to say, maybe with regard to something that you want to ask him. And so that's what the mic is there for. But we also have this other venue where you can text the question in, and that's why I have my phone here, all right? So if you want to go to the mic, you feel free to start making your way there. I already have a question that has come up here, and so I'm going to ask it. Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready.
All right. So the first question was this. What would you say to skeptics? Sorry. Here's the first question. What archaeological or historical evidence do we have for the martyrdoms of the disciples?
Okay, there is some archaeological evidence, but again, it's similar to the argument of verisimilitude. The evidence for the disciples is, on the whole, much sketchier than the evidence for Jesus, okay? And that's partly because the disciples scattered in all directions, and we're talking about different times and places. So you don't have a concentration in one spot in a two-year maybe 3-year period of time. So it's scattered, okay? But there is some evidence. The best book that I know on that subject is actually by Sean McDowell. Mm. I read the manuscript. I thought it was pretty good, and I endorsed it. But I forget the title, but something like
The
Fate of the Apostles.
Yeah, it was his dissertation, wasn't it?
Something like that, yeah. And so there is evidence, but it's fairly strong for 4 or 5 of them. And then it slowly tapers off. And in the case of 2 or 3 of the disciples, I'm not sure if we have any credible evidence. But he's trying to go beyond just legend and rumor that a 4th century church historian Eusebius might mention or somebody else. And by the way, that's the way it is with all history when we're talking about stuff 2,000 years old or older. You need to understand that. Perhaps I should add one more thing to that. We have 4 biographies for Jesus within a generation or generation of half. Do you know the only other people in antiquity that can compete with that are Roman emperors? So I bumped into myth and say, you'd think that, you know, Jesus, there'd be a lot more writing. Really? Jesus beats out almost all of the emperors. He beats out Alexander the Great. So you have 4 biographies within a generation and a little bit from the time of Jesus. And Josephus refers to him too. And then we got eyewitness stuff from Paul. I mean, that's a pretty good record. I mean, what do you expect? You know, and of course, when you think about it, there's an anachronism behind that. See, they're thinking, well, Jesus is super famous by the time you get to the 4th century. Well, yeah, he was very, very famous throughout the Roman Empire in the 4th century. But he wasn't famous throughout the Roman Empire 1 year after Pentecost. So it started out as a very obscure, small movement in an obscure part of the world. So you need to make allowance. And yet, he's got people talking about him in the 1st century, Roman historians talking about him at the beginning of the 2nd century. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So the second question, I think, will relate to some of the things that you were talking about in your first answer. What would you say to skeptics that say the writers of the New Testament just conspired in a cult-like collusion to write the New Testament? It's a good question.
Yeah, I know. It comes up. There was this writer that would do that kind of thing, Michael Bagent. He's deceased now. Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Dead Sea Scrolls, Deception. He's the one that inspired the naive Dan Brown to write Da Vinci Code and then sued Dan Brown and so on. It was quite a deal. And this thing is so backwards and naive. Historians don't pay any attention, and that was one of the reasons Brown had so much success, is because real scholars and historians thought it was laughable and just ignored it. It's just a murder mystery. It's a piece of fiction. It's a novel. Who would take that silly little fact page at the beginning of the novel seriously? Well, 100 million people did. And that's when the scholars said, ooh, maybe we should respond to popular writing that relates to our field when it's so egregiously wrong. And I remind my students or anyone who cares to listen, Dan Brown might bungle a book and sell 50 million copies, read by 100 million people, but I want you to know I worked for years to write books read by dozens. Okay? There is a difference between me and Dan Brown.
There is.
Yeah, I've got a book coming out called Jesus and the Manuscripts, very much to the point, that will be out in October. It's a lengthy book, and I've worked on it for years, and I'm hoping this time more than just dozens will read it.
Okay? He's looking at all of you right now.
Yeah. Can I sign
you all
up?
I can tell.
Golly, maybe this one will sell over 100. I'm getting optimistic. Well, anyway, the silly thing about that kind of a question, I don't mean the person asking the question is silly, but the silliness behind the thinking, again, is anachronism. So here you are, you're a Christian, and you believe in Jesus, and writings are starting to circulate, and it's the end of the 1st century, beginning of the 2nd century. How do you know there's even going to be a New Testament? The church has this thing called the Bible, or what we call the Old Testament. Isn't that enough? We've got the prophet Isaiah. We've got the book of Psalms. We've got Moses. What else do we need? And we have apostolic teaching explaining what it all means. We have Jesus' teaching. We've all remembered it, and we're all talking about it. So how would anyone even know there's going to be a New Testament? Number two, even if somebody thought, you know, we might gather some of these writings together someday and have a, what will we call it, a New Testament, how would he know which ones? This comes up in the debate with Bart Ehrman. Oh, you know, theological motivations changing the text. Really? Changing the text in the second century? How would they know how to change it? The Nicene Creed hasn't been hammered out. That doesn't happen until 325. It's a little late to change the manuscripts then because there are too many copies of them in Greek circulating, too many translations and copies of them in Latin, too many, and I could go on and on. There are thousands of them. How could there be a conspiracy to get together and say, we need to make a whole bunch of changes so they say the right thing about Jesus? It would simply be impossible. There's no internet. You can't post the correct version online. Use this one. You can't do it. So you can't so early on make these tricky little changes. There is no way, there's nothing that even motivates the conspiracy because nobody knows. Is there going to be a New Testament? What's going to be in it? Or what should the theological drift be? Do we make Jesus more divine or more human? Or how do we resolve grace? How do we understand, you know, election? I mean, all these things, how would anyone know that these things need to be tweaked in a certain way in the first or second century?
Good. Thanks, sir. You ready for another one?
I am.
And by the way, feel free to take the mic. I'm just taking the ones I look up, and if nobody's there, I just keep rolling here, okay? That's the way I'm going. Here's the third question. Doesn't the Bible have small inconsistencies? Like the Nazareth near the water example that you used earlier. So could that argument be used to cast doubt on the gospel accounts as well?
One could make that argument. I've debated again, Bart Ehrman, on that kind of point. Nowhere, though, do the gospels make a blunder like these examples I gave you from the Gospel of Barnabas. They never have the disciples rowing their boat to Jerusalem or rowing their boat to Nazareth. There, you know, if those kinds of things happened, I suspect those gospels would never have been included. Mm-hmm. The people that saw them as authoritative, they lived there. They knew these kinds of things. Now, the problem comes down for us. Some of it is a naive understanding of how the Bible should be understood this way, the text of the Bible. Word for word, you start getting into these kinds of things, inerrancy, inspiration, and that kind of thing. And then what do you do when a scribe copies, makes a mistake, copies the wrong word, someone else corrects it, somebody uses a synonym, somebody thinks he's actually helping to clarify the text? There are those kind of extremely minor things. But also, there's a whole thing about pedagogy that we today don't understand. And so I'll give you a real quick lesson on that. Pedagogy in antiquity encouraged people to think, to take the teaching of the scholar, the sage, and then apply it in different contexts and perhaps in different languages. Jesus taught his disciples that way also. And the clearest example of that is in Matthew 13. He's told them the parables. He says, do you understand what I've been teaching you? They say, yes. Good. Because then you're like that scribe, the scribe trained for the kingdom of heaven, is like the householder who pops open the treasure box and pulls out old stuff as well as new stuff. Old and new gets pulled out of the box. That's what he's talking about. And we're not used to that. In school, we tell our students, if you're using somebody's source, you quote it word for word, put it into quotation marks, and give me a footnote. Well, they did that, but they did more things. And how do we know? We actually have their school books. Several have been preserved. And they'll say, now the person that's been properly trained can pull out new insights and new meaning. He can take the teaching, he can expand it, He can shrink it. He can alter the way it's introduced. He can use different words if that helps make it clear. But you're always faithful to the message. That's what the Gospels do. And invariably, when you say, well, wait a minute, Matthew reads this way, Luke reads that way, that's exactly what's going on. My own reading of what the ancient church father Papias is saying, he personally was acquainted with the Apostle John. And Jeremy, if you want to talk about that, that's a new insight for me. Eusebius quotes all these people, and he does a hatchet job on Papias for eschatological reasons. Because the Roman Empire has become Christian, and oops, second century eschatology, where Jesus comes back and kills the Roman Emperor, doesn't play well with Constantine. So he does a hatchet job
of
Papias.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah. But here's the sad thing, you know, and so he creates the new John, a different John, not the apostle. Papias, he's from about the year 60 till his death about 120. 60 to 120, 125, he wrote a five-volume work. Tragically, it's lost, except for some quotations. In it, he refers to knowledge that he had. He first had firsthand knowledge of the elder John, the Apostle John. And he asked John a question. He said, look, Mark is Peter's secretary. Peter speaks, and what he speaks are crayi, anecdotes. And by the way, we now know what that means thanks to these school books. And Mark writes them down, but not in order. That doesn't mean they're out of order. It means they're not ready for publication. This now explains everything. This is Peter's notes written down by Mark, which Matthew, Mark, Luke, the canonical synoptic gospels utilized. That's why they share so much stuff in common. But following Jesus' lead, following the practices of the day, they edit, expand, shrink, rearrange as they see fit for their respective congregations and settings. And that's why you have these minor discrepancies. When you understand that, the problems just vanish. The problem is we don't know that. We don't understand the pedagogy of antiquity or the historiography, how biography and history was expected to be written. We don't know anything about that. We're the era of photography, tape recordings, exact word for word. It's reinforced in school. When you quote him, it's word for word. And so you're looking at Matthew and Luke, and wait a minute, this is the Lord's Prayer. It's here it is in Matthew 6, here it is in Luke 11, and it's not word for word. Who got it wrong? There was a cartoonist that wanted to make a joke out of this, and he had a cartoon one time, and it showed Jesus on the mount getting ready to deliver the Sermon on the Mount, and there's a crowd, and he says, now listen, I want you to listen carefully. I don't want four versions of this. But actually, he did, and he got four versions, and they've been very effective.
Good. Question. All right, we actually have someone at the mic, and so I'm going to go there, and then I'm going to go back to some questions here.
Hi. I recently heard Gary Habermas giving a lecture on the Shroud of Turin. I'm curious about your take on it as evidence for the resurrection. He even says, I'm 90% sure, after all the research he's done, would you use that as an apologetic?
Thank you for asking that question. It, you know, in a big public forum, I don't. Because I'm not a scientist, and I worry that, you know, whether it's Gary, and I'm glad Gary says 90%. I myself have not seen the original shroud. I know people who have. I know Barry Schwartz, who was the original filmographer and videographer in the 1978, the original first scientific test. And Barry Schwartz's testimony is very moving. He was about 30 years old at the time. He was a young Jewish atheist. And a lot of people don't know that, but most of the people that examined it were not believers. They were indifferent to the shroud. They assumed it was a medieval product of some sort. And he said there was a joke. They even had a pool where they were putting money in the pool to see who could guess how quickly they would be able to disprove it. We'll figure it out in 2 days. It'll take 3 days. Well, after they had done their work for 7 or 8 days and they were finished, they had not figured out how the image got the cloth. Now, for me, that's the takeaway. And by the way, that remains true to this day. Right. To me, that's the way I put it. I find it hard to understand. Everybody knows it's at least 700 years old. That's not disputed. How can something produce an antiquity, whether it was in 700 years ago or 2,000 years ago? How can anything produce an antiquity that puts an image, a very accurate, speaking of verisimilitude, a very accurate image of a crucified man, the way we now believe it would have been, not according to medieval artwork, the way it's supposed to be, in the cloth, complete with not just human blood stains, but blood stains from a human who suffered trauma, whose liver released the rubabelin. How the heck did the guy know that 700 years ago? So how does anybody produce this thing that 21st century rocket science can't explain? It's not a photograph. There is no photographic sensitive chemical in the cloth, so forget that one. And Da Vinci had nothing to do with it. This thing's at least 100 years older than Da Vinci. At least. So how did somebody in antiquity do something that modern science can't explain? To me, that is amazing. Now, maybe tomorrow or next year, it will be explained. That's why I think hedging a little bit and saying 90%. By the way, the latest theory scientifically is there's something happened on the molecular level. Well, gosh, does that help? Oh, so Da Vinci, maybe he did do it after all. I mean, you know, was he fooling around with molecules? Of course not. Of course not. I mean, this thing, they liken it to an atomic blast of some sort. I mean, that's not helping. You know, atomic science was pretty anemic 700 years ago. I mean, wasn't it? Okay, I'm ready.
So what I'm hearing is about 80% for you. I'm kidding. All right, so let me go on. Let's go.
I'm more like 92 or 93.
If you're in a good mood, you know, yeah. It ebbs and flows. Next question is, I had a coworker, not me, but the questioner, I had a coworker claim that there is limited to no support that Romans crucified in the iconic cross shape, implying that Jesus was not crucified.
Oh my.
Is there historic evidence for Roman crucifixion in the cross shape?
There certainly is. There certainly is. I looked at it in October. There are two Roman, since it's specifically Roman, two right. Roman depictions. I'm probably wrong. There are probably more like four or five, but off the top of my head, two. One at Puteoli, and which is second century, and one right there in Rome at the Palatine, in the Palatine Museum. It's known as the Palatine Graffito. Right. And it depicts crucified victims exactly like this on a tau-shaped, T-shaped cross. That's the earliest evidence we have of depiction of crucifixion, and it's exactly as early Christianity thought. We have manuscripts of the New Testament that date to the end of the second or probably beginning of the third century, and we have a compendium where you take a couple of letters of a word and merge them together. The word stauros, when it occurs, cross, is actually constructed in a way that creates a miniature T-shaped cross. There is no evidence of any other shape of cross. Okay, so that's part of the answer right there. Now, Josephus does tell us that when the Romans were enraged at the Jewish people for the rebellion and they surrounded Jerusalem in 69 and 70 before capturing the city, when they caught Jews trying to flee the city, they crucified them, and Josephus remarks, in weird postures, shapes, and designs, which would suggest that was not normal. They were just trying to get really gross and terrify the rebels in the city. So that's a summary of the evidence. So there's plenty of evidence, early evidence, of that shape, either like this with the head above it, or like this with the head in front of it, T-shaped, yes.
Good. Okay, so how do you explain information that is only cited in one of the four Gospels? like Matthew 27:51-53, which is the dead saints raising and walking the streets of Jerusalem, right? So how do you explain that? Maybe there's something that's unique to one of the Gospels you don't find in any of the others. What's going on there?
Okay, first, a general answer. Just because something is unique to one doesn't mean that that's a mark against it. We wouldn't do that with all of our historical documents from the past, because there are many, many things said about, in some cases, well-known figures, and we have it in only one source. And we might have three sources for that figure, but only some things are singly attested. So that principle in itself doesn't weaken or disqualify something. But that particular example does raise questions in my mind, because there are some oddities. Matthew, just to keep it simple, Matthew is very careful about chronology. Mark sometimes leaves you wondering, well, wait a minute, which happened? Wait, you know, it seems complicated. Matthew's real careful in smoothing things out. And then something funny happens in Matthew 27. And as Jeremy just said, it's only in this passage. Jesus is dying on the cross, and there's an earthquake. And then the text says, rocks split, tombs opened up, and saints came up and showed themselves. Then Sunday morning, there's an earthquake again, and Jesus is resurrected. Now, here's the problem that I have with that. Jesus is the first fruits of them that sleep, according to New Testament teaching. Well, according to this in this text in Matthew 27, he isn't. Them that sleep are these other saints, and they awaken Friday afternoon. Jesus hasn't even been buried yet. They wake up. And somebody seems to have caught that, because most manuscripts then have a phrase that said they waited in the tomb until Sunday morning. Ah, I see. But they're still resurrected. They're just tapping their toes in the tomb for the weekend, and then Sunday morning they leave. So my own theory, and I have no textual support for it except a minor textual problem in a Syriac version of Matthew 27, my own view is that somebody made a gloss, somebody wrote something in the margin and heard a rumor, and I'm assuming this is a very early gloss, early second century, that then is very early, so that it ended up getting it brought into the text. Maybe it's a first century gloss. Because and put it in a margin between the two columns, and then somebody inserted it on Friday's earthquake instead of the Sunday morning earthquake. And the two columns are side by side. They're not that far apart, the two earthquakes, in terms of the number of verses.
So they put it in the wrong place.
Put it in the wrong place. Now, that's just a theory. That's, you know, on my part. Don't go out and say, oh, well, that settles it, because it hasn't. But I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if we found an early second century fragment of Matthew, or a late first century fragment of Matthew, and it happened to be toward the end of Matthew chapter 27, and those two verses weren't there. I wouldn't be this, by the way, nobody would be surprised. This has happened. John chapter 5 talks about an angel coming down and stirring the pool. Well, guess what? As we got our older manuscripts, and we happen to have two very old ones of John, P75 and P66, that little suspected verse isn't there. It was a gloss somebody wrote. And see, people, you know, you write marginal notes in your Bible, don't you? Well, when the books were handwritten and you write the same style of Greek and you put it in the margin, a later scribe might think that, this is a correction. Somebody noticed a piece of a verse missing, and then they bring it into the text. And that happens, and that's why, thank goodness, we have over 5,000 manuscripts, and we compare them, and we get back to what we believe really is the original. But in one or two cases, we're not sure, and this is one of them.
There you go. So the whole foundation of the Christian faith is based on both the existence and resurrection of Jesus. There is evidence that Jesus exists, but what evidence is there that he resurrected?
Well, I shared that in my presentation. I can elaborate it on greatly. I would recommend that questioner, if that questioner wants to pursue it, if anyone here would like to pursue that further, there are two great resources. There's Michael Lycona's book. I believe it's 2010. on the resurrection, mm-hmm. InterVarsity Press, thick 500-page book. It's probably the best book in English on the topic. But another great scholar that addresses the question has already been mentioned, Gary Habermas. And so Gary Habermas, Mike Lycona, great studies on the resurrection. I just would go back to what I showed you on the slides a little while ago. A fictional account would have told the story differently. If Jesus wasn't resurrected, if there were nothing more than rumors and somebody said, hey, look, let's narrate this, try to do it convincingly, then having two frightened, confused women show up at the tomb is not the smartest way to do it. You would do probably something a little more like what the author of the Gospel of Peter did in the second century. The other thing is we do have firsthand testimony from the guy who saw Jesus himself and did not expect to see him and did not believe in him, and that was Saul of Tarsus, who became the famous Apostle Paul. To me, that's very significant evidence.
Yeah, so the creed in 1 Corinthians 15, I think it's 3 through 8, is earlier than even what we have in the Gospels,
yes.
Right? So what would you say the dating of the creed in 1 Corinthians 15 would roughly be?
We assume Paul heard that creed, where he said that what I have received, I passed on to you, or I passed on to you, I delivered to you what I received, that Christ was put to death for our sins and was buried on the third day. According to scriptures, he was raised up and on he goes. And then he appeared to Peter, then he appeared, and he appeared and appeared and appeared and appeared, and then finally to me, last of all. So that's what Jeremy's referring to. Well, right. Most other than the appeared last of all, that's where Paul has added to it. But most think that this creed came into existence within the first year of the church, if not weeks, or a couple of months of the beginning of the church following the Easter announcement. So this is as early as can be. Then Paul himself became a Christian. Now remember, Paul was an enemy until he became a Christian, a believer. Paul was a, therefore, non-Christian, as it were, from the time of Easter till his conversion for anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years. Most would agree it's not longer than 2 years. So he becomes a Christian in the church's infancy. Now, as an enemy of the church, don't you think he would collect all the counter-narrative, all of the poop that he could find that would show that the Christian claims were false? Wouldn't he? He's right there. He's in Jerusalem. He knows the parties involved. He is familiar with the priests who condemned Jesus. He has access. He persecuted. He participated in the murder of Stephen. So he knows all the players on either side. And if he had caught wind that, this we really don't know what happened to Jesus. Or if somebody said, well, I guess it's all visionary because his tomb is right over there. And I'm assuming they'll gather up his bones eventually and take him back up to Nazareth. He would have known that stuff. There isn't a trace of anything like that. He supports the narratives themselves and met the risen Christ himself. And we have his letters. It's not secondhand or third hand. We don't have people saying, I remember Paul saying that. I think I remember it correctly. We have his letters. I think it's very important.
So one of the theories that goes against the resurrection, and one of the questions that came up, is there any evidence to support the idea that the disciples stole Jesus' body? Well, it was a popular theory,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know.
By the way, they added, tactically, this seems unlikely, smiley face.
Very unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely. But could they have been part of some kind of conspiracy to steal the body?
I think it's highly unlikely. And what gets lost in this, and it's a point that I hope at some point I can make myself, because I just don't see it in the literature, and that is we're forgetting who the disciples of Jesus were. We're forgetting who his following, who they were. They were Jews who believed in their scriptures, believed in the patriarchal promises, they believed in the prophecies. The Jewish people had a coherent religious faith in God. They believed in a resurrection. They believed in an afterlife. So it's not like, oh my goodness, I didn't see it coming. Jesus has died. I have to do something now to compensate for this. I'm now psychologically at risk because, so I'm going to have to invent something. Although he told us never to lie and be honest, I'm going to tell a gross lie and say he was raised from the dead. And I know perfectly well he wasn't. And then I will expend my life propagating this untruth. Not only is it psychologically unrealistic, but what gets lost in this, there would be no motivation to do it at all. And you look at Josephus and his history, and there were other people who claimed to be prophets, and I think three or four of them claimed to be messiahs, and that led to violence. People got killed. The leader was killed. And every single time, the following disperses. Not once do you have a group of people saying, you know, let's just go out and tell everybody that Yohanan was raised up. That's a good idea. Not once. It's not like, oh, well, you know, that's what they always do when their rabbi gets killed. They come up with a story about him being resurrected. They don't. They don't have to. They're disappointed. They go, well, I thought Eliezer was the one, but I guess he wasn't. Oh, well, back to the farm. It is. It is. And so the reaction of the disciples initially is exactly that. Oh, the two on the road to Emmaus. I don't get it. I thought he was the one. The other disciples, back to the boats. And that doesn't mean they lost faith. Doesn't mean they lost faith in God. Doesn't mean I can't be a believing Torah observant Jew anymore. Right. It doesn't mean their eschatology goes out the window. It's just, oh, well, maybe next year or the year after. See, that's an important point that needs to be made. For the disciples, they're Jews. They believe in scriptures. They believe in the prophecies and the promises. Jesus, I sure look promising, but in the end it went south, so I'm going home. Then the resurrection happens. What? And the reaction initially is skepticism and confusion. Until they actually meet him and they have their experience with him, as then not long after Paul would too.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and their reaction, as some have pointed out, their reaction is not what you would think if you're trying to load the deck and writing a book, right? No. So we want to load the deck in favor of the resurrection of Jesus. And so what we're going to include is people running away from it. Their initial reaction is to not believe in it.
Yeah.
Has to appear to Peter multiple times before Peter is like, oh, it is you.
Yeah, really. It gets kind of silly. Let's see now. What do we need? We get frightened women, disciples who run away. One of them betrays Jesus. I like that. I like that. Let's go with that. He commits suicide. Ooh, lay it on. And then you got Peter three times, not once, three times saying, I don't know who he is.
Right.
I mean, really? That's the way you decide to tell the story? And by the way, the skeptics mocked Christians in the Gospels for those reasons. Oh, if Jesus had really been a God, he would have known better. He would have picked better disciples. He would not have allowed anyone to slap him around. And that the reaction is very much the way humans think. And that's what Paul talks about, power perfected in weakness. You know, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Why would he say that in Romans 1? Because there's a lot to be ashamed about from a Roman point of view. This is your Son of God. This is your Savior. Slapped around, shamed, brutalized, and crucified. He is your Son of God. You must be kidding. Why would you make up a story like that? You could tell it a lot better.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to do one more. Are you ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Unless nobody's at the mic, so we're going to do one more. Are y'all ready for it? All right, so here it is. It's how we end the night. How do we know the early church assembled the right 27 books for the New Testament? And I want you to take it book by book. And I want you to do it in 30 seconds. So how do we know that the 27 books are right? I mean, there were some that didn't make the cut, right?
That's right. Some didn't make the cut. I have a book coming out. I co-authored with Lee McDonald and John Collins on this very subject. And it'll be out. By the way, we're getting up into that 93-94 number.
All right.
So next time you don't undersell me.
Okay? All right.
Okay. Anyway, it's a minimalist canon, interestingly enough. And what the church fathers did, there were more than 27 books on the table. And they talked about it. And, you know, two-thirds would say, well, we're happy with that book. But I was, no, come on, there's some problems here. So it was very, very democratic. Democratic every step of the way. When the books were first written and began to circulate, people would say, yeah, that's good. Let's read it in our church. And by the way, reading it in church was the standard. That was the beginning of canonization. And you can actually see comments made in the 3rd, 4th centuries where they say, you shouldn't read that in church. That Gospel of Peter that circulated, we have a story about it by Eusebius, the church history, and he refers to the bishop, Serapion, and this is around 140. Bishop Serapion initially allowed it to be read in church till he read it. He goes, oh, wait a minute, there's some problems here. So he sends out a note to all of his churches, he's a bishop, and says, don't read this thing in your churches anymore. I really don't think Peter wrote it. And so there were all those kinds of questions. So it's very democratic. And so there wasn't some council that got together that conspired to come up with these writings and not those other ones, mm-hmm. which is often the way it's phrased, especially Dan Brown and Bagent, whose source he used, this idea that there are 80 gospels out of there. So let's pick out the ones that don't show Jesus as a real man. That is really naive, because the Gnostic Gospels denied the real manness of Jesus, and he's a ghost. He only looks like a real person, or he's borrowing somebody's body. He's a body snatcher, and he's just there for a little while and then slips away. That's what the heretics were doing. They were denying the humanity of Jesus, not the other way around. And the Christians were saying, no, those gospels are late, they're spurious, they're not apostolic. We want to deal with the real Jesus, the one who is in fact human. And that's what incarnation means. So there's no conspiracy, and the canon is smaller than it might have been, because there was a desire to, let's only include the books we all agree are okay. We've been reading them in the churches for generations. And so the canon was a little smaller. They did the same thing with the Old Testament. That's where we came up with the Apocrypha. So these books, a lot of these books that aren't in the canon are perfectly worth reading. I just wouldn't build doctrine on them. I don't assign to them authority. But I read them all because it helps me understand these things a lot better. Now, here's what I tell my students when they ask this question. How do we know? Maybe the church made a mistake. Maybe the church left out some books that should be included. I said, good, here's a collection of them right here. Read them. You read all that stuff that's left out, and you tell me. They come back after they read and go, oh, man, the church didn't make any mistake at all. So you do it. If you have any questions, there's nothing here to hide. Some of these texts, we have them in full. Some of them only in part, quotations or whatever. Read them. Come back and tell me. Nobody has ever come back to me and said, oh, Shazam, I wish we'd kept the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Thomas, or, oh, what a shame that we didn't keep the Acts of Pilate. Nobody has ever said that. Maybe you'll be the first.
Good. Good.
I doubt it.
Man, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Appreciate
You're
you
welcome.
Having me here. Thanks for taking the questions. All right. So, my friends, if you want some more information about the work that Craig does, you actually have a website. It's craigevans.com, right?
Craig A. Evans.
Craig A. Evans.
.com.
And so I certainly invite you to go there. We want his books to be widely read, don't we? And especially the new one that's coming out. We're all going to go buy it, aren't we? When is it out?
October. You can find it on Amazon. So if you just put in Evans, Jesus and the Manuscripts, boop, up it comes, and it says, you can have it in April, but I'm telling you right now, no, you can't. You can't have it in April, but October.
Yeah, there you go. So you can certainly go to his website, check it out. I'm sure that there are some talks that are there that are included as well, and more information on your other work. Give a round of applause to Craig again for coming, giving the time, helping us out. I also want to say, keep your eyes open for the next Veritas event. We have yet to set the date, but I'm talking to another special guest speaker. We're going to have a very interesting topic, but I'm not going to tell you what it is just yet. All right? So you have to keep following us on the socials, and we'll have another evening just like tonight, and we'd love to have you there as well. Until then, have a great evening. Have a great week. God bless.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information on Veritas, visit www.veritaswbc.com.